If we want to be old-fashioned about it, before Einstein, we can say that this situation is nothing unusual. By definition, the laws of mechanics and the geometry of Euclid are valid only in inertial systems. That is what makes them inertial systems. We simply don't consider coordinate systems which are not inertial. This was really the position of physicists before Albert Einstein. This is exactly what seemed wrong to Einstein. His idea was to create a physics valid for all coordinate systems, since the universe abounds with the non-inertial as well as the inertial kind. If we are to create such a universally valid physics, a general physics, then we must treat both the observers in the stationary, inertial system, and the observer in the revolving circles, a non-inertial system, with equal seriousness. The person on the revolving circles has as much right to relate the physical world to his frame of reference as we have to relate it to ours. True, the laws of mechanics as well as the geometry of Euclid are not valid in his frame of reference, but every deviation from them can be explained in terms of a gravitational field which affects his frame of reference. This is what Einstein's theory allows us to do. It allows us to express the laws of physics in such a way that they are independent of specific space-time coordinates. Space and time coordinates, measurements, vary from one frame of reference to the other, depending upon the state of motion of the frame of reference. The general theory of relativity allows us to universalize the laws of physics and to apply them to all frames of reference. Wait a minute, we say. How can anyone measure distance or navigate in a coordinate system like the one on the revolving circles? The length of a ruler varies from place to place in such a system. The farther we go from the center, the faster the velocity of the ruler, and the more it contracts. This doesn't happen in an inertial coordinate system, which in effect is a system that is at rest. Because there is no change of velocity throughout an inertial coordinate system, rulers do not change length. This allows us to organize inertial systems like a city, block by block. Since rulers do not change length in inertial systems, all the blocks that are laid out with the same ruler will be the same length. No matter where we travel, we know that 10 blocks is twice the distance of 5 blocks. In a non-inertial system, the velocity of the system varies from place to place. This means that the length of a ruler varies from place to place. If we use the same ruler to lay out all the city blocks in a non-inertial coordinate system, some of them would be larger than others depending upon where they were located. What is wrong with that? Asks Jim DeWitt, as long as we still can determine our position in the coordinate system. Imagine a sheet of India rubber, on which we have drawn a grid so that it looks like a piece of graph paper. This is a coordinate system. Assuming that we are at the lower left corner, we can start anywhere. Let us say that a party Saturday night is being held at a given intersection on the graph. To get there, we have to go 2 squares to the right and 2 squares up. Now suppose that we stretch the sheet of rubber so that the top is longer than the bottom. The same directions, 2 squares right and 2 squares up, still bring us to the party. The only difference is that unless we are familiar with this part of the coordinate system, we cannot calculate the distance that we have to travel as easily as we could if all the squares were the same size. According to the general theory of relativity, gravity, which is the equivalent of acceleration, is what distorts the space-time continuum in a manner analogous to our stretching the sheet of rubber. Where the effects of gravity can be neglected, the space-time continuum is like the sheet of rubber before we stretched it. All of the lines are straight lines, and all of the clocks are synchronized. In other words, the undistorted sheet of rubber is analogous to the space-time continuum of an inertial coordinate system, and the special theory of relativity applies. However, in the universe at large, gravity cannot be neglected. Wherever there is a piece of matter, it warps the space-time continuum. The larger the piece of matter, the more pronounced the warp. In the example of the revolving circles, the variation of velocity in different parts of the coordinate system caused the ruler to change size. With that in mind, remember that acceleration, change in velocity, is the equivalent of gravity. Therefore, changes in the strength of a gravitational field will produce the same contractions of the ruler as changes in velocity. Acceleration and gravity are two ways of saying the same thing. That means that if a ruler is subjected to gravitational fields of different strength, it changes length. Of course, it is impossible to travel through our solar system, much less our galaxy, without encountering gravitational fields of varying intensity, which would cause any maps that we somehow could produce to look distorted like the stretched piece of India rubber. The terrain of the space-time continuum in which our Earth moves is like a hilly countryside with a mountain, the sun, dominating the geography. According to Newton, the Earth wants to continue forever in a straight line, but forever is deflected from its inclination by the gravitational force of the sun. A balance of the two keeps the Earth in orbit around the sun. According to Einstein, the Earth's orbit is simply the easiest path for the Earth to take as it moves through the space-time continuum, warped as it is in this neighborhood by the sun. Imagine how complex is the geography of the space-time continuum, which is our universe, with its solar systems, star systems, galaxies, and galaxy clusters, each of them causing major and minor bumps, curves, hills, valleys, and mountains in the four-dimensional space-time continuum. Would it be possible to navigate under such circumstances? Yes. Although it is a crude example, sailors navigate under somewhat analogous circumstances. We cover the Earth with squares which are formed by lines of latitude and longitude. The size of these squares varies depending upon where they are located. The closer they are to the equator, the larger they are. If this is unclear, look at a globe. Nonetheless, we can still locate physical points on the surface of the Earth by designating the intersection of a line of latitude and a line of longitude. Knowing the number of squares between us and where we want to sail does not give us the distance to our destination because the squares may vary in size. However, if we know the nature of our terrain, a globe, we can calculate distances on it using spherical trigonometry. Similarly, once we know the properties of an area of the space-time continuum by exploring it, we can determine not only the position of, but also the distance, interval, between two events in the space-time continuum. The mathematical structure of the general theory of relativity, which Einstein created over a period of 10 years, permits us to do just that. The equations of the general theory of relativity are structural formulas. They describe the structure of changing gravitational fields. Newton's formula describes a situation between two objects at a given time. Einstein's formulas relate a situation here and now to a situation in the immediate vicinity a little later. By feeding the results of actual observations into these equations, they give us a picture of the space-time continuum in the neighborhood of our observations. In other words, they reveal the geometry of space-time in that area. Once we know that, our situation is roughly analogous to that of a sailor who knows that the Earth is round and also knows spherical trigonometry. We have said up to now that matter distorts or causes a curvature of the space-time continuum in its vicinity. According to Einstein's ultimate vision, which he never proved, demonstrated mathematically, a piece of matter is a curvature of the space-time continuum. In other words, according to Einstein's ultimate vision, there are no such things as gravitational fields and masses. They are only mental creations. No such things exist in the real world. There is no such thing as gravity. Gravity is the equivalent of acceleration, which is motion. There is no such thing as matter. Matter is a curvature of the space-time continuum. There is not even such a thing as energy. Energy equals mass, and mass is space-time curvature. What we considered to be a planet with its own gravitational field moving around the sun in an orbit created by the gravitational attraction, force, of the sun, is actually a pronounced curvature of the space-time continuum, finding its easiest path through the space-time continuum in the vicinity of a very pronounced curvature of the space-time continuum. There is nothing but space-time and motion, and they, in effect, are the same thing. Here is an exquisite presentation, in completely Western terms, of the most fundamental aspect of Taoist and Buddhist philosophies. Physics is the study of physical reality. If a theory does not relate to the physical world, it may be pure mathematics, poetry, or blank verse, but it is not physics. The question is, does Einstein's fantastic theory really work? The answer is a slightly tentative, but generally accepted, yes. Most physicists agree that the general theory of relativity is a valid way of viewing large-scale phenomena, and at the same time, most physicists still are eager to see more evidence to confirm or challenge this position. Since the general theory of relativity deals with vast expanses of the universe, its proof, of usefulness, not of truth, the watch is still unopenable, cannot come from observations of phenomena limited to the Earth. For this reason, its verifications come from astronomy. Thus far, the general theory of relativity has been verified in four ways. The first three ways are straightforward and convincing. The last way, if early observations are correct, may be more fantastic than the theory itself. The first verification of the general theory of relativity came as an unexpected benefit to astronomers. Newton's law of gravity purported to describe the orbits of the planets around the sun, and it did, all of them except Mercury. Mercury orbits the sun in such a way that some parts of its orbit bring it closer to the sun than others. The part of Mercury's orbit closest to the sun is called its perihelion. The first verification of Einstein's general theory of relativity turned out to be the long-sought explanation of the problem of Mercury's perihelion. The problem with Mercury's perihelion, in fact with Mercury's entire orbit, is that it moves. Instead of continuously retracing its path around the sun relative to a coordinate system attached to the sun, Mercury's orbit itself revolves around the sun. The rate of revolution is extremely slow. It completes one revolution around the sun every 3 million years. This still was enough to puzzle astronomers. Prior to Einstein, this precession in Mercury's orbit had been attributed to an undiscovered planet in our solar system. By the time Einstein published his general theory of relativity, the search for this mysterious planet was well underway. Einstein created his general theory of relativity without special attention to the perihelion of Mercury. However, when the general theory of relativity was applied to this problem, it showed that Mercury moves precisely as Mercury has to move through the space-time continuum in that vicinity of the Sun. The other planets do not move significantly in this way because they are farther away from the Sun's gravity. Score 1 for the general theory. The second verification of the general theory of relativity was the fulfillment of a prediction specifically made by Einstein. Einstein predicted that light beams are bent by gravitational fields. He also predicted exactly how much they are bent, and he suggested an experiment to test this prediction. Einstein suggested that astronomers measure the deflection of starlight by the gravitational field of the sun. According to Einstein, the presence of the sun between a group of visible stars and the Earth will cause an apparent change in the position of the stars, because light coming from them will be bent by the gravitational field of the sun. In order to perform this experiment, it is necessary to photograph a group of stars at night, noting their positions relative to each other and other stars on their periphery, and then to photograph the same group during the day when the sun is between them and us. Of course, stars can only be photographed in the daytime during a total eclipse of the sun by the moon. Astronomers consulted their star charts and discovered that May 29th is the ideal day for such an undertaking. This is because the sun, in its apparent journey across a varied stellar background, is in front of an exceptionally rich grouping of bright stars on that date. By incredible coincidence, a total eclipse of the sun occurred on May 29, 1919, only 4 years after the general theory was published. Preparations were made to use this event to test Einstein's new theory. Light signals from a star are bent in the neighborhood of the sun. Because we assume that starlight travels in a straight line, we assume that the star is in a position other than it actually is. Although light was supposed to travel in a straight line in a vacuum, a certain amount of bending already was theorized before Einstein's general theory of relativity. Newton's law of gravity was used to calculate this bending, even though it could not explain it. Einstein's theory predicted roughly twice the deflection that Newton's law predicted, and in addition, it supplied an explanation for it. Physicists and astronomers alike eagerly awaited the outcome of this confrontation between the new theory and the old. The 1919 eclipse was photographed by two different expeditions sent to two different parts of the world. These expeditions also took photographs of the same stellar background at times when the sun was not in the area. The results of both expeditions vindicated Einstein's calculations, not Newton's. Since 1919, the same verdict has been reached again and again during other eclipses. All of them confirm Einstein's predictions. Score 2 for the general theory. The third verification of the general theory of relativity is called gravitational redshift. Remember that gravity, because it is the equivalent of acceleration, not only causes rulers to contract, but it also causes clocks to run more slowly. A clock is anything that repeats itself periodically. An atom is a type of clock. It vibrates at a certain frequency. When a substance like sodium is made to glow, the wavelength of the light that it emits can be measured accurately. This wavelength tells us exactly the frequency of the vibrations of the atoms that comprise the substance. If the frequency should vary, the wavelength also will vary. If we want to compare the rhythm of a clock here on the Earth with the rhythm of a clock that is influenced by an intense gravitational field like that of the Sun, we do not need to send a clock to the surface of the Sun. The clocks already are in place. Einstein predicted that any periodic process that takes place in an atom on the Sun, where the gravity is very intense, must take place at a slightly slower rate than it does here on the Earth. To test this prediction, all we need do is compare the wavelength of the radiation of a given element as it is found in sunlight and as it is found here on Earth in the laboratory. This has been done many times. In each case, the wavelength measured from the sunlight was found to be longer than its laboratory counterpart. A longer wavelength means a lower, slower frequency. Sodium atoms, for example, vibrate more slowly under the influence of the sun's strong gravitational field than they do on the Earth. So do all the atoms. This phenomenon is called gravitational redshift because the wavelengths involved appear to be shifted slightly toward the red end of the visible light spectrum, where the wavelengths are the longest. Score 3 for the general theory. Mercury's moving perihelion, starlight deflection, and gravitational redshift are all observable phenomena. Now we come to an area where theory is still predominant and observation is minimal. Nonetheless, it is an area that is by far the most exciting and perhaps the most stimulating in the entire history of science. The fourth verification of the general theory of relativity appears to be the phenomenon of the black hole. In 1958, David Finkelstein published a paper in which he theorized, on the basis of Einstein's general theory of relativity, a phenomenon that he called a one-way membrane. Finkelstein showed that under certain conditions involving an extremely dense gravitational field, an invisible threshold can occur into which light and physical objects can enter, but from which they can never again escape. Footnote. This phenomenon was theorized by Pierre-Simon Laplace in 1795 using Newtonian physics. Finkelstein was the first physicist to formulate it from the modern point of view, i.e. relativity theory. This modern formulation triggered the current theories on the black hole. End of footnote. The following year, a young graduate student at the University of London heard Finkelstein, who was speaking there as a guest lecturer, explain his one-way membrane. The idea caught his attention and then his imagination. The young student was Roger Penrose. Expanding on Finkelstein's discovery, he developed it into the modern theory of the black hole. Footnote. The very first modern paper on black holes was done by J.R. Oppenheimer and S. Snyder in 1939. The current theories of the black hole, i.e. black hole singularities which are beyond space-time, were developed independently by R. Penrose and S. W. Hawking. End of footnote. A black hole is an area of space which appears absolutely black because the gravitation there is so intense that not even light can escape into the surrounding areas. Footnote, to a first approximation, physicists currently theorize that black holes actually shine due to photons and other particles quantum tunneling out of the one-way membranes. End of footnote. Gravitation is negligible on the laboratory level, but quite important when bodies of large mass are concerned. Therefore, the exploration of black holes naturally became a joint venture of physicists and astronomers. Astronomers speculated that a black hole may be one of several possible products of stellar evolution. Stars do not burn indefinitely. They evolve through a life cycle which begins with hydrogen gas and sometimes ends with a very dense, burned-out, rotating mass. The exact end product of this process depends upon the size of the star undergoing it. According to one theory, stars which are about 3 times the size of our Sun or larger end up as black holes. The remains of such stars are unimaginably dense. They may be only a few miles in diameter and yet contain the entire mass of a star 3 times larger than the Sun. Such a dense mass produces a gravitational field strong enough to pull everything in its vicinity into it, while at the same time allowing nothing, not even light, to escape from it. Surrounding this remainder of a star is an event horizon. an event horizon is created by the enormous gravitational field of the burned-out star. It functions precisely like Finkelstein's one-way membrane. Anything within the gravitational field of this mass quickly is pulled toward it, and once past the event horizon, never can return. It is the event horizon which constitutes the essential feature of the black hole. What happens to an object that passes through an event horizon is even more fantastic than the wildest, currently, science fiction. If the black hole is not rotating, the object will be pulled directly to the center of the black hole to a point called the singularity. There it literally will be squeezed out of existence, or as physicists say, to zero volume. At the black hole singularity, all of the laws of physics break down completely, and even space and time disappear. It is speculated that everything which is sucked into a black hole is spilled out again on the other side being another universe. If the black hole is rotating, an object that is sucked into the event horizon could miss the black hole singularity, which is shaped like a ring in a rotating black hole, and emerge into another time and another place in this universe, through wormholes, or into another universe, through Einstein-Rosen bridges. In this way, rotating black holes may be the ultimate time machines. Although black holes are almost invisible, we can search for observable phenomena that may be characteristic of them. The first of these is a large amount of electromagnetic radiation. A black hole continuously attracts hydrogen atoms, cosmic particles, and everything else to it. As these particles and objects are drawn to the black hole, they steadily accelerate through its gravitational field until they approach the velocity of light itself. This causes tremendous amounts of electromagnetic radiation. Any accelerating charged particle creates electromagnetic radiation. The second observable characteristic of an invisible black hole is its effect on a nearby visible star. If a visible star can be found which moves as though it were revolving around an invisible star, i.e. as though it were half of a binary star system, we might speculate that it actually is revolving around an invisible star and that its invisible partner is a black hole. The search for black holes consequently became the search for these two phenomena. In 1970, the satellite Uhuru located both of them in one area. It pinpointed a high-energy X-ray source in the constellation Cygnus, which emits a million times more energy than the Sun. This high-energy source of electromagnetic radiation, which came to be known as Cygnus X1, is very close to a visible blue-hot supergiant star. Scientists now believe that this blue supergiant forms a binary system with the black hole, Cygnus X1. As the visible star and the invisible black hole orbit each other, the blue supergiant literally is being sucked into the black hole. As material is torn away from its surface, it plunges into the black hole at tremendous speed, emitting X-rays. Incredible as Cygnus X1 is, more than 100 similar objects have been detected within our own Milky Way galaxy since its discovery. Although black holes stretch our imagination to the limit, the evidence is mounting that they actually do exist. For example, if black holes are as we have speculated them to be, whatever disappears into them reappears somewhere. Is it possible, therefore, that there are black holes in other universes which are sucking matter from those universes into our universe? This is a seriously considered possibility. There are objects in our universe that appear to be the reverse of black holes. They are called white holes, of course. These objects are quasi-stellar radio sources, or quasars for short. Quasars are extraordinarily intense energy sources. Most of them are only several times the diameter of our solar system, yet they emit more energy than an entire galaxy of over 150 billion stars. Some astronomers believe that quasars are the most distant objects ever detected, yet their incredible brightness allows us to see them clearly. The relationship between black holes and quasars is purely speculation, but the speculation is mind-boggling. For example, some physicists speculate that black holes swallow up matter from one universe and pump it either into another universe or into another part and time of the same universe. The output side of a black hole, according to this hypothesis, is a quasar. If this speculation is correct, then our universe is being sucked into its many black holes, only to reappear in other universes, while other universes are being pumped into our own universe, which is being sucked through black holes and into other universes again. The process goes on and on, feeding on itself, another beginningless, endless, endless, beginningless dance. One of the most profound byproducts of the general theory of relativity is the discovery that gravitational force, which we had so long taken to be a real and independently existing thing, is actually our mental creation. There is no such thing in the real world. The planets do not orbit the sun because the sun exerts an invisible gravitational force on them. They follow the paths that they do because those paths are the easiest ways for them to traverse the terrain of the space-time continuum in which they find themselves. The same is true for nonsense. It is a mental creation. There is no such thing in the real world. From one frame of reference, black holes and event horizons make sense. From another frame of reference, absolute non-motion makes sense. Neither is nonsense except as seen from another point of view. We call something nonsense if it does not agree with the rational edifices that we carefully have constructed. However, there is nothing intrinsically valuable about these edifices. In fact, they themselves often are replaced by more useful ones. When that happens, what was nonsensical from an old frame of reference can make sense from a new frame of reference and the other way round. Like measurements of space and time, the concept of nonsense, itself a type of measurement, is relative, and we always can be sure when we use it that from some frame of reference it applies to us. Part 1. I Clutch My Ideas. Chapter 1. The Particle Zoo. The fourth translation of Wu Li is, I Clutch My Ideas. This is appropriate to a book on physics, since the history of science in general often has been the story of scientists vigorously fighting an onslaught of new ideas. This is because it is difficult to relinquish the sense of security that comes from a long and rewarding acquaintance with a particular worldview. The value of a physical theory depends upon its usefulness. In this sense, the history of physical theories might be said to resemble the history of individual personality traits. Most of us responded to our environment with a collection of automatic responses that once brought desirable results, usually in childhood. Unfortunately, if the environment that produced these responses changes, we grow up, and the responses themselves do not adapt, they become counterproductive. Showing anger, becoming depressed, flattering, crying, and bullying behavior are response patterns appropriate to times often long past. These patterns change only when we are forced to realize that they are no longer productive. Even then, change is often painful and slow. The same is true of scientific theories. Not one person, except Copernicus, wanted to accept the Copernican idea that the Earth revolves around the sun. Goethe wrote about the Copernican Revolution, "Perhaps a greater demand has never been laid upon mankind. For by this admission, that the Earth is not the center of the universe, how much else did not collapse in dust and smoke? A second paradise, a world of innocence, poetry and piety, the witness of the senses, the convictions of a poetic and religious faith? No wonder that men had no stomach for all this, that they ranged themselves in every way against such a doctrine." Not one physicist, not even Planck himself, wanted to accept the implications of Planck's discovery, for to do so threatened a scientific structure, Newtonian physics, over 300 years old. Heisenberg wrote about the quantum revolution, "When new groups of phenomena compel changes in the pattern of thought, even the most eminent of physicists find immense difficulties. For the demand of change in the thought pattern may engender the feeling that the ground is to be pulled from under one's feet. I believe that the difficulties at this point can hardly be overestimated. Once one has experienced the desperation with which clever and conciliatory men of science react to the demand for a change in the thought pattern, one can only be amazed that such revolutions in science have actually been possible at all." Scientific revolutions are forced upon us by the discovery of phenomena that are not comprehensible in terms of the old theories. Old theories die hard. Much more is at stake than the theories themselves. To give up our privileged position at the center of the universe, as Copernicus asked, was an enormous psychological task. To accept that nature is fundamentally irrational, governed by chance, which is the essential statement of quantum mechanics, is a powerful blow to the intellect. Nonetheless, as new theories demonstrate superior utility, their adversaries, however reluctantly, have little choice but to accept them. In so doing, they also must grant a measure of recognition to the world views that accompany them. Today, particle accelerators, bubble chambers, and computer printouts are giving birth to another worldview. This worldview is as different from the worldview at the beginning of this century as the Copernican worldview was from its predecessors. It calls upon us to relinquish many of our closely clutched ideas. In this worldview, there is no substance. The most common question that we can ask about an object is, what is it made of? That question, however, what is it made of, is based upon an artificial mental structure that is much like a hall of mirrors. If we stand directly between two mirrors and look into one, we see our reflection, and just behind ourselves we see a crowd of us's, each looking at the back of the head in front of it, stretching backward as far as we can see. These reflections, all of them, are illusions. The only real thing in the whole setting is us, we. This situation is very similar to what happens whenever we ask of something, what is it made of? The answer to such a question is always another something to which we can apply the same question. Suppose, for example, that we ask of an ordinary toothpick, what is it made of? The answer, of course, is wood. However, the question itself has taken us into a hall of mirrors, because now we can ask about the wood, what is it made of? Closer examination reveals that wood is made of fibers, but what the fibers are made of is another question, and so on. Like a pair of parallel mirrors, reflecting reflections, giving the illusion of an unending progression to nowhere, the idea that a thing can be different from what it is made of creates an infinite progression of answers, leaving us forever frustrated in an unending search. No matter what something, anything, is made of, we have created an illusion which forces us to ask, yes, but what is that made of? Physicists are people who have pursued tenaciously this endless series of questions. What they have found is startling. Wood fibers, to continue the example, are actually patterns of cells. Cells under magnification are revealed to be patterns of molecules. Molecules under higher magnification are discovered to be patterns of atoms, and lastly, atoms have turned out to be patterns of subatomic particles. In other words, matter is actually a series of patterns out of focus. The search for the ultimate stuff of the universe ends with the discovery that there isn't any. If there is any ultimate stuff of the universe, it is pure energy. But subatomic particles are not made of energy. They are energy. This is what Einstein theorized in 1905. Subatomic interactions, therefore, are interactions of energy with energy. At the subatomic level, there is no longer a clear distinction between what is and what happens, between the actor and the action. At the subatomic level, the dancer and the dance are one. According to particle physics, the world is fundamentally dancing energy, energy that is everywhere and incessantly assuming first this form and then that. What we have been calling matter, particles, constantly is being created, annihilated, and created again. This happens as particles interact, and it also happens, literally, out of nowhere. Where there was nothing, there suddenly is something, and then the something is gone again, often changing it to something else before vanishing. In particle physics, there is no distinction between empty, as in empty space, and not empty, or between something and not something. The world of particle physics is a world of sparkling energy, forever dancing with itself in the form of its particles as they twinkle in and out of existence, collide, transmute, and disappear again. The worldview of particle physics is a picture of chaos beneath order. At the fundamental level is a confusion of continual creation, annihilation, and transformation. Above this confusion, limiting the forms that it can take, are a set of conservation laws. They do not specify what must happen, as ordinary laws of physics do. Rather, they specify what cannot happen. They are permissive laws. At the subatomic level, absolutely everything that is not forbidden by the conservation laws actually happens. Quantum theory describes the probabilities of the possibilities permitted by the conservation laws. As Jack Sarfati wrote, "Particles no longer move stiffly and formally, if not majestically, in predetermined paths. Rather, it is Marx Brothers' hyperkinetic pandemonium, Charlie Chaplin's slapstick, helter-skelter, now you see it, now you don't. In fact, it is not even clear what it is that has a path. It's psychedelic confusion, until one sees the subtle order." The old worldview was a picture of order beneath chaos. It assumed that beneath the prolific confusion of detail that constitutes our daily experience lie systematic and rational laws which relate them one and all. This was Newton's great insight. The same laws which govern falling apples govern the motion of planets. There is still, of course, much truth in this, but the worldview of particle physics is essentially the opposite. The worldview of particle physics is that of a world without stuff, where what is equals what happens, and where an unending tumultuous dance of creation, annihilation, and transformation runs unabated within a framework of conservation laws and probability. High-energy particle physics is the study of subatomic particles. It is usually shortened to particle physics. Quantum theory and relativity are the theoretical tools of particle physics. The hardware of particle physics is housed in unimaginably expensive facilities which couple particle accelerators and computers. The original purpose of particle physics was to discover the ultimate building blocks of the universe. This was to be accomplished by breaking matter into smaller and smaller pieces, eventually arriving at the smallest pieces possible. The experimental results of particle physics, however, have not been so simple. Today, most particle physicists are engaged in making sense out of their copious findings. Footnote: the present state of high-energy theory is similar to Ptolemaic astronomy before its collapse under the pressure of the new Copernican worldview. The discovery of new particles and new quantum numbers, e.g. charm, to be discussed later, is analogous to the addition of epicycles piled on an already unwieldy theoretical structure. End of footnote. In principle, particle physics hardly could be simpler. Physicists send subatomic particles smashing into each other as hard as they can. They use one particle to shatter another particle so that they can see what the remains are made of. The particle that does the smashing is called the projectile, and the particle that gets smashed is called the target. The most advanced and expensive particle accelerators send both the projectile and the target particles flying toward a common collision point. The collision point is usually located inside a device called a bubble chamber. As charged particles move through a bubble chamber, they leave trails, similar to the vapor trails that jetliners leave in the atmosphere. The bubble chamber is located inside a magnetic field. This causes particles with a positive charge to curve in one direction and particles with a negative charge to curve in the opposite direction. The mass of the particle can be determined by the tightness of the curve that the particle makes. Lighter particles curve more than heavier particles with the same velocity and charge. A computer-triggered camera makes a photograph every time a particle enters the bubble chamber. This elaborate arrangement is necessary because most particles live much less than a millionth of a second and are too small to be observed directly. Footnote: the dark adapted eye can detect single photons. All of the other subatomic particles must be detected indirectly. End of footnote. In general, everything a particle physicist knows about subatomic particles he deduces from his theories and from photographs of the tracks that particles leave in a bubble chamber. Footnote: in addition to bubble chamber physics, there is emulsion, photographic plate physics, counter physics, etc. However, the bubble chamber is probably the most commonly used detection device in particle physics. End of footnote. Bubble chamber photographs, thousands and thousands of them, show clearly the frustrating situation which early particle physicists encountered in their search for elementary particles. When the projectile strikes the target, both particles are destroyed at the point of impact. In their place, however, are created new particles, all of which are as elementary as the original particles and often as massive as the original particles. For example, a particle called a negative pi meson collides with a proton. Both the pi meson and the proton are destroyed, and in their place are created two new particles, a neutral K meson and a lambda particle. Both of these particles decay spontaneously, no collision necessary, into two additional particles, leaving four new particles. Of these four particles, two of them are the same particles that we started with. It is as though, wrote Finkelstein, we fling two clocks together, they shatter, and out of them come flying not gears and springs, but more clocks, some of them as large as the originals. How can this happen? The answer is partly given by Einstein's special theory of relativity. The new particles are created from the kinetic energy, energy of motion, of the projectile particle, in addition to the mass of the projectile particle and the mass of the target particle. The faster the projectile particle is traveling, the more kinetic energy is available to create new particles at the point of impact. For this reason, governments have spent more and more money to construct larger and larger particle accelerators, which can push projectile particles to higher and higher velocities. If both the projectile particle and the target particle are accelerated to the point of impact, so much the more kinetic energy is available to create new particles to study. Every subatomic interaction consists of the annihilation of the original particles and the creation of new subatomic particles. The subatomic world is a continual dance of creation and annihilation, of mass changing to energy and energy changing to mass. Transient forms sparkle in and out of existence, creating a never-ending, forever newly created reality. Mystics from both the East and the West who claim to have beheld the face of God speak in terms so similar to these that any psychologist who professes an interest in altered states of awareness scarcely can ignore this obvious bridge between the disciplines of physics and psychology. The first question of particle physics is, what collides? According to quantum mechanics, a subatomic particle is not a particle like a particle of dust. Rather, subatomic particles are tendencies to exist and correlations between macroscopic observables. They have no objective existence. That means that we cannot assume, if we are to use quantum theory, that particles have an existence apart from their interactions with a measuring device. As Heisenberg wrote, "In the light of the quantum theory, elementary particles are no longer real in the same sense as objects of daily life, trees or stones." When an electron, for example, passes through a photographic plate, it leaves a visible track behind it. This track, under close examination, is actually a series of dots. Each dot is a grain of silver formed by the electron's interaction with atoms in the photographic plate. Ordinarily, we would assume that one and the same electron, like a little baseball, went streaking through the photographic plate and left this trail of silver grains behind it. This is a mistake. Quantum mechanics tells us the same thing that tantric Buddhists have been saying for a millennium. The connection between the dots, the moving object, is a product of our minds, and it is not really there. In rigorous quantum mechanical terms, the moving object, the particle with an independent existence, is an unprovable assumption. According to our customary way of reasoning, wrote David Bohm, professor of physics at Birkbeck College, University of London, we could suppose that the track of grains of silver indicates that a real electron moves continuously through space in a path somewhere near these grains, and by interaction caused the formation of the grains. But according to the usual interpretation of the quantum theory, it would be incorrect to suppose that this really happened. All that we can say is that certain grains appeared, but we must not try to imagine that these grains were produced by a real object moving through space, in the way in which we usually think of objects moving through space. For although this idea of a continuously moving object is good enough for an approximate theory, we would discover that it would break down in a very exact theory.